Hi, I'm Adam Sanford. I'm an academic life coach and professor in Los Angeles.
And I'm Dinur Bloom. I'm a college professor in Los Angeles. And this is Learning Made Easier, a podcast where we discuss how we learn, how we teach, and how they overlap.
This is episode 2. And in episode 2, we're going to talk about pulling back the curtain. And this is about things that students don't understand about what teachers do, how we do it, and even why we do it. And we're going to talk about 5 main things today. The first thing that we're going to talk about is why we set up our courses the way we do. So I'll let Dinur riff on that for a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Adam. So something that we always try and communicate to our students is what we want them to learn, both in terms of material, but also in terms of skill. And the way we do that when we're trying to be effective is we try and schedule our outlines and schedule our topics so that one kind of leads into another and builds on one another. But that said, one thing that I always tell my students early on in the semester is your first few lectures are probably the driest material we will deal with. And I tell them that I'm not trying to put them to sleep. I'm not trying to get them to drop the class. But the dry material always sets us up for kind of more interesting, juicier material to get into during the heart of the term. And so if we don't have a basic foundation, how can we expect to build a good house? How can I expect my students to know what I'm talking about if we haven't given them, or if I haven't given them, you know, certain tools early on?
Yeah, and I was thinking about this particular thing this morning about how it's going to be boring in the beginning and then it'll get really interesting once we get past the boring. And it seems like no matter what class I teach, you know, because I also teach, I'll be prepping this morning. I'm prepping for a theory class. And part of the theory class, I'm required to teach them how to construct a theory. Well, that means they need to know all the different building blocks. So I'm trying to make it a little more interesting. I've given them a lecture. It was pretty dry, you know, that they watched online. And I was creating a Kahoot quiz so that they can basically check, do I know all of this material? And, but it's still pretty basic, you know, pretty dry. Here's a way to categorize theory, blah. You know, until they get to the actual material, it's going to be, why am I learning this? You know, I had a student yesterday say, well, why did I read all this stuff in the book if I'm not going to be using it in class today? And I said, well, because the book is supplemental. You know, you're going to get most of what you need from the lectures. But we also have to think about, you know, it's great to learn about, say, how this education system works or how this criminological issue is approached. But if you don't have the basic undergirding background, then you're lost because it's just, here's an interesting story instead of how do we connect this to what the main points are of the course. And some of the considerations we have to make, I mean, I've had students say, well, you didn't cover chapter 9 and chapter 10 in the book. And that's because we only have 15 weeks. And so I had to make a decision about, all right, what am I going to emphasize? You know, in the fall, there are 2 days that I have to take off due to religious considerations. So in the fall, if I'm teaching a criminology class, they don't get a class on organized crime. Because organized crime, for me, is a 3-day arc. Of classes. But in the spring, I don't have to take any of those days off. So I'm able to give them the 3 days of organized crime, but then I drop the juvenile delinquency day because, you know, I need that day for the organized crime. So these are considerations we have to make too in terms of what we're going to present. A lot of students come into college and they assume that, you know, that they're going to teach me everything in the book. When really, when you get to college, one of the things you need to know is that the book is something for you to read, but the teacher may not even talk about the book at all. They may talk about other things, and the book is sort of, look, here's the basic stuff you got to know in order to do what you need to do, but we're not going to talk about that in class.
And I know for me, I'm teaching an intro to sociology course right now, and I'm structuring my class a bit unconventionally, where from about day 2, we start hammering methods right away before we get into concepts, because assuming that most of my students aren't taking this in their fourth year to try and finish up some units, research is something that they're going to have to struggle with and they're going to have to deal with in future classes. Mm-hmm. You know, even if they're not sociology majors, I want to give them the background to knowing how to do research and to understanding why theory is important. And I really try and emphasize that these are two sides of the same coin because something I've seen is students tend to think of theory as one universe, research as its own universe, without a link between. And I want to try and emphasize that, you know, no, these are two things that go together. They try and explain what we're seeing. But my trade-off is I'm not going through the book. I'm not giving them a lot of terminology from the book early on. I'm having them read, and I'm giving them some low-stakes quizzes to see how they do.
And then the other thing about considerations is, you know, for example, if you're teaching an intro class, most of your students aren't going to be majors in your discipline. So I remember back when I was in undergrad, I was taking a Sociology 100 course, and there was a student there who was a math major, and he said, "This is really useless to me. How am I ever going to use it in my life?" And the teacher had some trouble explaining that. And, you know, for those of us who aren't math people, we might say, you know, apart from balancing my checkbook, when am I ever going to use math in my life? You know, algebra doesn't seem to be useful to me. So one of the things that I would recommend that that teachers do is make clear to the students, this is the reason why we've got this boring stuff at the beginning. You know, if I teach a stats class, I actually spend about 2 weeks going back over algebra to make sure that the students are aware of, you know, here's what we need to do. Don't be afraid of math. I have them explain some very basic stuff like how addition works without using the word add.
Okay.
And how subtraction works without using the word subtract, so that they get used to explaining results, explaining mathematical results without using the terms of the math. And some of the students have told me that my statistics boot camps have really made them more confident, even though it looked like dry material at the time. You know, when they get into running a t-test and they're saying, oh, I remember this from the stats boot camp, this is what this means, you know. And so I recommend that no matter what subject you're teaching, that if you have to give a boot campy kind of thing at the beginning of the class, and a lot of instructors do have to give that, they have to say, you know, this is the basic foundation, as Denor said, on what we're building. You need to know that. So students, be aware of that. When, you know, when you're taking a class, it may seem really boring, but almost always there is a method to the teacher's madness. There's a reason that they're telling you about this very basic stuff, because in week 10, you might need to know it. You know, you might need to be able to pull back on that. When I teach a deviant behavior class, I teach two or three main deviant behavior theories and ways of categorizing different kinds of deviant behavior. And then we talk about, after that, once I've taught them, here are the categorization ways, you know, here's the ways you're going to categorize all these things. Then I talk about this kind of deviant behavior and that kind of deviant behavior, and I have them go back and use what they learned in the first 2 weeks about how to categorize, and it deepens their understanding of the material. So that may be the reason that your teacher's asking you to do this stuff that doesn't seem to have any connection to the material, but it does. Okay, there is a method to our madness. Now, the second thing is that we design the assignments to meet the goals of the course. And if you've ever looked at a syllabus and it might have something like course goals or course objectives or learning objectives, you know, these are the things that usually it's our departments that tell us, you got to make sure they learn this stuff. This is what you have to cover in the course. So when we design an assignment, a lot of times students may think of it as just, you know, busy work. So for example, you've got a worksheet every week that your teacher has you do, you may say, this is just busy work. Why am I doing it? Well, part of it might be to give you a low stakes chance to learn something without risking a lot of points or risking, you know, your grade. And another thing might be that it is something that repetition lends itself well to learning, you know, that if you do it over and over again, it begins to stick, kind of like math. You know, the best math teachers, they're not just teaching the current math, they also have review problems in every exam so that you are remembering that you also did this back in week 3. You know, here it is on the week 6 test or the midterm. You also have to know that so that you can grab that when you need it and you can use it when you need it. So when I have a course goal, my course goals, what I will do is I'll look at them and I'll usually try to develop one low stakes or maybe two low stakes and one high stakes assignment for each course goal, so that if you blow it on a low stakes assignment, you can learn before the high stakes assignment comes up. And I also try to design my classes so that nothing is really high stakes, so that nothing is more than maybe 10% of your grade, so that if you do blow it on that assignment, you don't feel like, oh God, I've just blown the entire class. Because remember, your teachers are not trying to set you up to fail, even though it may seem that way, we're not. It's just we expect you to learn, and sometimes that's hard.
And I'm similar to you, although I think my high stakes assignments go up to 15 or 20%. But my whole idea is I don't want a bad test to torpedo a student's grade. I don't get joy out of giving a bad grade. And so I want everything to be a little bit lower stakes. I make their term paper be worth about as much as one exam or sometimes slightly more, because I feel like that gives my students more control over their grade. Mm-hmm. They have a longer time to work on the material. They can talk to me a lot more, whereas they don't get to talk to me when they're taking an exam. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea is you want students to develop their knowledge, show that they're developing their knowledge and their skills, but you also don't want to put so much weight into a grade that a student might get paralyzed with fear of failure.
Mm-hmm. Because then the paralysis leads to the failure, because students who get paralyzed with fear, they can't move forward. You know, I've had students come to me and say, I have test anxiety, and I tell them, don't worry, my tests are set up so that if you fail one, you get the chance to retake it. Okay. And I try to set it up so that, for example, all the tests I give my students, I give them at home. You know, they can take them, they are either take home tests or they take online at home tests, so that if they need to sit there in their pajamas with a cup of hot cocoa and, you know, and I don't know, a plate of nachos or something, just so that they feel comfortable taking their exam, they can do that. Okay. And they can take it at a time that works for them. If they're a night owl and my class is at 8:30 in the morning, they're not going to be prepared for a test at 8:30 in the morning. They're going to be tired. And if they're a lark and they're taking an evening class, you know, they're done. You know, they come to class and they're already kind of, you know, maybe that's the only time that they could get that class. So then why make them take the exam at 10 at night or 9 at night when they're tired? You know, I try to arrange it so that the student can work with their own rhythms and, you know, and take the exam when they feel like they're on top of things, when they feel like they're ready to do it. So, and I'm not saying, oh, just let your student take the test whenever, but I am saying if you're going to schedule it on a day, you know, you could schedule the exams outside of class. That gives you more time to do material in class. And you can schedule the exams outside of class. Just make them open book and open note. There's almost nothing you're teaching that your students should have to memorize at this point. All right. I had a prof back in undergrad. I took a business math class and he gave us open book exams. He says, I don't expect you to memorize these. I expect you to keep the book on your shelf when you become an accountant so you can pull it down and look up the stupid formula. That's not, you know, you shouldn't have to memorize this. You should just have to understand why you're doing it.
And I'm very much the same way. My students take their exams online. They take them at home. I make them open book, open note, open reading. But I also tell them that they need to know their stuff because they will not have enough time to go through each and every slide, each and every reading as they're taking the exam. Mm-hmm. Right? And I tell them, I'm testing to see how well, you know, you can bring up this knowledge that we've talked about, how well you can analyze something if they're given a chart and I tell, you know, that we've covered in class. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, and I tell them, I want you to take this when you're ready because I want to see your best shot.
Yeah. And a lot of students don't realize this. So students, we're talking to you now. We want to see your best work, but your best work may vary from day to day. Like if you have a day, like when we're recording this morning, my father-in-law had a heart attack this morning. And so now he's in the hospital. So I'm probably not completely at my best today, but you may have an experience where, you know, you just did not get enough sleep for whatever reason. You know, you were up late dealing with a family issue or a relationship issue, or you were sick. But bring your best shot to class every day that you can, and you'll do better. You know, bring your best self, bring your best work. All right. Don't turn in something just to turn in something. Really work on turning it in because you want to present your best work, because that's what we're looking for. And that brings us to things that actually brings us to our next topic in a way, because, you know, what are we looking for? Well, we're looking for your best work, but that doesn't mean that we're looking for you to memorize everything and spit it back out on the test. So when we design our test questions, a lot of students will say, well, I don't know what you're looking for. Well, tests are often multiple choice, even in college. So a lot of it is, you know, do you know the terminology? But some of it, as Denora was saying, is, you know, it's got to be, you got to show that you can analyze this thing or that you can take this tool that you've learned in class and apply it. You know, there's a tool that I teach in my theory classes where I teach them how to break up a theory by five main things that all the theorists talk about. So if I were to give an essay question on an exam, I would probably say, using this framework that you've learned and we've gone over in every lab class, take this theory and break it down and show me that you can break it down. Well, that goes beyond memorization. Right? When you're doing a test, the word test is a scary word. The word exam is a scary word. A lot of students just hear those words and they freeze. And so teachers, try calling them quizzes or even something like knowledge assessments so that the student doesn't hear the word exam or test and immediately go, ah, you know, because you don't want to have people panicking when they're taking your exams. You want people to be calm and taking them, you know, with a good mindset about, okay, I've got this, I can do this. And Denor, you wanted to mention something about the logic of the test question exactly. Tell us more about that. Tell me more about that.
So one thing that I do when I write my tests is I actually do not have my students do short answers or full essays on my exams. And I tell them that I do this on purpose. That being, I don't believe I get their best writing on a timed exam. Right? They might throw a few concepts here and there, but I'm not going to see, you know, full analysis simply because there's not enough time to develop a good, you know, a good thought. So what I do is I test my students kind of on their basic analysis and basic skills with multiple choice and with true false questions. And for the most part, I try and ask fairly straightforward questions, with the exceptions that I am that jerk instructor who likes to do the A and C or all of the above as two answer choices. You know, just to see how well students can bring up that information and go, oh, right, we talked about these two things, but maybe not that third, versus how many people go, yeah, that third kind of sounds right, worth going with all of the above. But I also tell my students that I expect good writing when they do their term papers, because we schedule several workshops, which I actually model after Adam's student writing workshops. We do that in class. We have a class-wide brainstorming session where I ask students to break down the questions I ask in their term paper prompt. We discuss it as a class, and I post those, their answers, their responses on Moodle for them so that they have a resource to use. And they can say, oh yeah, I was writing this. Oh yeah, we talked about this. Why don't I go back to that? But I expect a much better paper because I've spent a lot of time working with them. In class, I allow them to come to my office hours. Obviously, they can email me. So I want good, polished work by the time I read their final drafts.
And I want to go back to what you said about the logic of multiple choice true falsers. For me, what I'll do with a lot of multiple choice questions is I won't give, you know, the multiple choice question will be, which of these terms means blah, and then you list four terms. Well, what I do is I give a situation where they have to figure out that's about this term. So like, so in a criminology class, for example, and I pulled this from the musical, The Book of Mormon, we're testing to see, do they know the four types of deviance that that a man named Becker listed? And one of them is the pure deviant who does something deviant and does get caught. So he does something deviant, he gets caught, he gets punished. But then there's the secret deviant who does something deviant and doesn't get caught and doesn't get punished. And then there's the falsely accused who didn't do anything wrong, but they get punished. And then there's the conformist who didn't do anything wrong and doesn't get punished. So those are the four categories. So what I want the students to do is look at the situation that I give them and decide which of those four terms applies to the situation. So I would say, you know, Kevin stole a donut and blamed it on his brother Jack. His parents punished Jack for taking the donut. In this situation, Kevin is a, and then I give them the four: secret deviant, pure deviant, blah, blah, blah. And they have to figure out. And in this case, of course, Kevin would be a secret deviant because he did the bad thing, but he didn't get punished, someone else did. But I could ask the exact same question, and instead of saying, Kevin is, what is Jack? Well, Jack would be falsely accused, right? And so that forces them to do a little bit of analysis. So students, when you get a teacher asking questions like that, you've got to realize you're going to have to go deeper than just, you know, here's the answer. It's not just here's the answer. It's why is that the answer? You have to understand what you're being asked and not just treat it like, okay, I'm just going to spit back the answers, you know, and I've already caught students doing this in my first 2 weeks of classes at my current job that I'm teaching. I had a bunch of students misread a question because they were rushing. And I pointed that out. I said, okay, this is going to give you a hint about my tests. You need to read the question and make sure you understand it. If you rush, you will get it wrong. If you get it wrong, there's going to be problems. So, and you talked about term papers, Denor, and that was the fourth thing we were going to talk about today, is why do we make our students write so much? Because unless you're an English teacher, a lot of students don't expect writing. But then you get a writing assignment in your economics class or in your history class or even in your physics class. And you're like, well, why do I have to worry about things like spelling and grammar? I mean, this isn't an English class. And if you're in a course that there's any kind of writing assignment, you need to understand the goal of writing is to communicate, not just to make your English teacher happy. And a lot of English teachers, and we'll do a podcast specifically on this later, we'll do an episode on this, a lot of English teachers teach a particular style of writing, the humanities style, which is very loaded with lots of vocabulary words and lots of flowery language and lots of beautiful phrases. But if you're writing a report for physics that doesn't really work. You know, you need to change to a different style of writing. And you need to learn how to write in that style as well. And Denor mentioned the writer's workshops. Both he and I give writer's workshops to our classes where we talk about, okay, so you're in a social science, this is science writing, not humanities writing. Now, if they were in, you know, an English literature class, they would be expected to write in a more florid, a more wordy style, because that is what that kind of class requires. And so part of, you know, making you write, students, folks, is because we expect you to learn how to communicate what you know in more than one way, not just in taking an exam, but in also telling us, here's what I've learned, here's what I found out, here's why it's important, here's where the research and the support for it is.
And I have students that will absolutely resent me for this, but I give them the warning. If I ever see them starting a paper with throughout history, or over the centuries, or over the course of humanity, if they don't have a source for it, I'm not counting it.
There was a fellow who called that throat clearing. You know, since the dawn of time, people have, and I tell my students that this is basically you saying, I have nothing really important to say here, so I'm just going to keep on writing a lot of words and hope that you haven't noticed that I haven't said anything important in two paragraphs. And a lot of my students look at me like, but that's how my English teacher taught me to write. And for English classes, that's how you write, but not for science, not for social science, you know, not even for your econ class. You know, you need to write in a clearer style. So right. Since the dawn of time, stop using that. And teachers who are listening in, if you want to see the writer's workshops, you can email us. Just send us a message through the Patreon page at patreon.com/learningmadeeasier. And we'll be more than happy to send you copies of the writer's workshops.
And one thing I tell my students when they write their papers is that the faster they make their points, the faster I give them their points to try and get them away from the flowery language. I want simple, I want direct, and I want very clear. I like to have them apply concepts from a certain article to a documentary. And so I want them to work with the definitions of, you know, of the concepts, explain them in their own words, and then tell me how they see these concepts in the documentary. And then I have them tell me which concept they thought was strongest out of the ones they compared.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the last main point we want to make about the way that we design our classes is we aren't just focusing on you doing this in our course. What we're trying to do is get you to develop skills that you can use in other courses, in work, you know, when you get a job. In our modern society, you can't really get a job without knowing how to communicate in writing. There's just, you know, you have to write emails, you have to write reports. I had a student say, well, where am I going to use this as a cop? And I said, aren't you going to have to write reports? They're going to have to be clear enough that the court will accept them, right? Because if they're all jumbled and gobbledygooky and full of flowery words, nobody wants to read that. You need to write clearly, concisely, and completely. And those are my three, you know, how you said, you know, the faster you make your points, the faster you get the points. Well, one of the buzzwords in my classroom is clear, concise, and complete. Okay, you got to write clearly, concisely, and completely. And I designed my course around the idea that the stuff you're writing is stuff you will need to do again and again when you get the job that you want to get, whatever that job is. And a lot of students think that it's just busy work. I promise you, it's almost never busy work. What I'm hoping is that students have gotten something out of, you know, oh, that's why they do that. And now teachers, we want to talk directly to you. You got to make this stuff clear to your students. Because if you don't make it clear to your students, you're going to have resentful students. You're going to have students who say, why should I bother doing yet another worksheet? What is the point? You know, you've got to show the students the point. One of the ways to make it clear to the students why you're doing these things and why you're assigning these assignments is to use Marianne Winkelmuss's purpose task criteria assignment sheet format, where you say, this is why you're doing it. This is what you need to do. Here are all the steps. And here's how you're going to be evaluated. This is the criteria. This is what I'm going to judge you against. Because I've had students say, knowing that I really do expect them not to make more than 2 spelling errors per page has made them really, really aware that they need to check for spelling problems and not trust their spell checker. Because when we get to the podcast about that, we'll talk about some of the amusing mistakes that have been made with spell checkers. But you've got to make this clear to your students, because if you don't, they won't know what you want. And if they don't know what you want, they're going to feel like you're not doing your job. So Denor and I, over the course of this, we usually set up these, or we're usually going to set up these episodes as we'll talk about the issue, and then we'll talk about how teachers can use it and how students can use it. But we've kind of interleaved that into our discussion this time. So Denor, is there anything you want to say specifically to teachers or to students? I think we've pretty much covered the field here.
I think we have both, but one thing that I'd like to remind teachers is that we're teaching students more than we're teaching courses. And what that means is each of your classes is going to learn at their own pace. It may be faster than the pace you anticipated. It may be slower than the pace you anticipated. And I'm right now going through a class where we're a little bit behind where I thought we'd be. But you have to be okay with that. And you have to be able to explain, hey, here's what I'm trying to develop. And that development can take time. But you have to explain that to your students because you want them to understand that you're in the same boat with them rather than you're up above telling them what to do and they're just moving around in the dark, not seeing, you know, what your larger point is. You know what you want to get because you're the one who writes the syllabus. You have your own ideas for what you expect to see in terms of progress. We know what we're looking for, or we have at least an idea of what we want to cover, what we'd like to see, and we adjust as we go along. Our students weren't involved in that creative process, right? Our students aren't sitting in the room with us going, yeah, that seems like a good way to build this class, or that seems like a really interesting topic.
Or this seems like a good exercise that'll get the point across. You know, they don't see any of that. I had a student say to me, well, I thought that you guys just got a package from the department and then you taught from it.
Wow.
And it turned out they had gone to a charter school where their teachers were all given packages and they weren't allowed to develop their own curricula. They had to teach whatever the school taught them. And I said, that's not how it works in college. That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. But the thing is, some of your students may think that you didn't actually do it. You were just handed it and you're just teaching some of the material that you were handed. They may not realize how much work you put into it. You know, I prepped 5 classes last fall and I spent the entire summer prepping. I was spending probably 7-8 hours a day. I mean, a full, 6 days a week to get all these classes prepped and recorded, you know, get all my videos recorded, get everything set up. But I had it launchable at the beginning of class. Of course, I was exhausted for the first 2 weeks of the semester, but, you know, that was okay because I was ad drop. But the thing is that a lot of the students don't realize how much work goes into these or how much time it takes to prepare all this stuff. And when they complain, and then when they complain about how much time it takes to do a term paper, I'll say, well, I spent 39 hours prepping this class. So if you spend 10 hours on your term paper, I'm really not sympathetic. you should be able to spend that much time. So, but in any case, so teachers, remember, you got to pull back the curtain for your students, because if they don't understand how you got to where you are, they won't understand how you expect them to get to where they need to be.
And to me, pulling back the curtain is us being honest and it with our students, and it's respecting them. It's showing them, here's what we want you to do, because both Adam and I take a coaching approach to teaching. And the job of a coach in any sport is to get their players in the best position to succeed. It's up to the players to make the efforts and put in the effort to make the plays. Well, one way you can do that is by showing, here's the scheme of the class. Here's what I want you to do. And here's what I need to see from you at these steps.
Mm-hmm. So that's the end of episode 2. And when we come back with episode 3 next week, you'll hear about how we are going to explain how to slow down, because learning is not a race. And we'll see you then.
You've been listening to Learning Made Easier, a podcast about how we learn, how we teach, and how they overlap.
We want to say thank you to all of our supporters on Patreon who make this podcast possible.
If you want to support us, please go to www.patreon.com/learningmadeeasier.
And we look forward to seeing you next week.